So we are again using a sutta from this book, In the Buddha's Words, today, edited by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And the story might be a familiar one. It's sometimes translated as the two arrows. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as the two darts. And the sutta itself, interestingly to me, describes the first dart as a painful feeling in the body, and the second one as a painful feeling in the mind. He says, "Monks, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. Suppose they were to strike a man with a dart and then strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart, so that the man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So too, when the uninstructed worldling," in other words, someone that's not practicing meditation, is what that means, "experiences a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one." So this should all sound somewhat familiar to all of us. I think perhaps in our society, the first dart is mental as often as it is physical. And in reading this, I was thinking, well, I wonder if it was really different in the Buddha's time. Maybe so. It was an agricultural society. They may have had more physical ills than mental. But humanity is humanity. I mean, we certainly have more opportunities for mental anguish than they might have in those days. You know, we have a 24-hour news cycle. We have radio, television that enables us to feel the pain of people thousands of miles away instantly. So maybe so. But either way, even though this sutta of the two darts expresses it in terms of the first painful feeling being physical and then all the ones subsequent to that being mental, it doesn't really matter. It can be either one. And so the thing, if you take the handout here, the untrained mind, which I prefer for uninstructed worldling, the untrained mind on the left experiences a painful feeling. Could be physical, could be mental. The sutta goes on to explain that rather than just feeling that as being unpleasant, as being painful, we experience aversion to that. We don't like painful feelings. And instantly, as it says in the sutta, immediately, that's the second dart. Is that feeling aversion actually has an intensification of the unpleasant feeling. So that's the reason that I've done the little arrows sort of getting bigger and bigger as we go down the page. The aversion is a further tightening, it's a further constriction, and it's, in a way, it's more intense than the original unpleasant feeling. First of all, we haven't really felt the unpleasant feeling in the first place. We're not really turning our attention to it and fully experiencing it. We're trying to get away from it. And unfortunately, when we try to get away from things, they actually cause us more harm than if we'd actually pay attention to them. We're not used to that. Our tendency is to want to run toward the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. That's sort of our evolutionary wiring, is to move away from the unpleasant. Helpful for survival. You put your hand in the flame, it's pretty useful to pull that hand out when you experience that pain. But when this is extended to something like the painful feeling that comes when someone calls us a name we don't like, then it's not quite as beneficial from a survival point of view, but we still do it. Now, this is interesting. I've never seen this particular formulation in any other sutta, but From aversion, the sutta says that the untrained mind, after moving to aversion, tries to get away from it by seeking delight in sensual pleasure. I thought that was really interesting. We might think of that as, at least in my world, you stub your toe and to feel better you go eat a pint of ice cream. It's that same impulse. It's not really dealing with the issue at hand, you know, but it's using some compensatory behavior to deal with, in quotes, the pain we're feeling without actually dealing with it. We're ignoring it, and we're trying to get away from it by seeking delight and sensual pleasure. Now, that would be wonderful if sensual pleasure was a long-term solution for happiness, but turns out it is not. Several reasons for that. The primary one is that it's impermanent. There may be a little moment of gratification when we actually experience, you know, the last bite of that pint of ice cream, but when it's gone, it's gone. And no holding on is going to keep it around. So this continual impulse to seek delight in sensual pleasure, although we may get momentary relief at times from that, as a long-term solution, it's not going to work, because those little moments of gratification are impermanent. The sutta goes on to explain in a level of detail that is sort of unusual, that the reason we seek delight and sensual pleasure is an underlying tendency to lust for sensual pleasure. So these underlying tendencies are what in other contexts we've called the latent defilements. So we have the transgressive defilements. That's when we're out there in the world using unskillful speech and behavior, harming ourselves and others in really obvious ways. And in the three trainings of the Noble Eightfold Path, the first training is in morality and sila. And that training in sila overcomes those transgressive defilements. We learn not to be acting that out in the world, these impulses that we have, these harmful impulses toward ourselves and others, in unskillful speech and behavior. So those are the transgressive defilements. But that's not sufficient, because the obsessive defilements still remain, the tendency of the thoughts. So we've dialed it back from unskillful action in the world, we've dialed it back from unskillful speech, but we're still having those unskillful thoughts. They're still popping into our minds. Oh, if she had said, and if I had said, and all of that. So the way we deal with that is through the training in samadhi, by concentration and by effort, mindfulness and concentration, we're actually able to uproot eventually those obsessive defilements. And in the meantime, they're getting less intense and they're getting less frequent. But that's not enough for complete freedom. Even after we've dealt with the transgressive and obsessive defilements, we still have the latent defilements. The latent defilements are these underlying tendencies. They're quiet. They're sort of waiting in the weeds. And when the right trigger comes along, our reaction is to have these things rise up again. So even though they're not active all the time and we're not necessarily falling prey to them under every condition, under the right set of conditions, because as we know, everything is due to causes and conditions, when the right set of conditions arise, then these latent defilements will show their heads. So this underlying tendency, as we're talking about here, the lust for sensual pleasure is an underlying tendency that is not uprooted until we're pretty far along the path. We tend to want to like sensual pleasure and to want more of it. And then the next step is, or the next underlying cause for all of this, is that we're ignorant of this formula that's called gratification, danger, and escape. So these three terms, gratification, danger, and escape, are used frequently throughout the suttas. And it's one of these things where there's two different ways of understanding them. One is the sort of ignorant way of understanding them, and one is the once we've achieved the knowledge of it. So ignorance of gratification, danger, and escape is that the untrained mind thinks that these little fleeting sensual pleasures are actually gratifying based on our experience with a brief moment of satisfaction when we eat that ice cream or whatever unskillful behavior we engage in repeatedly. We've felt that little gratification and we forget that it's impermanent. We haven't fully developed our understanding of anicca or impermanence. The danger is that very impermanence. The danger is believing that that's actually going to satisfy us and give us long-term happiness when it actually won't. And the escape to the untrained mind gets us back to this seeking delight and sensual pleasure. And all of that leads to suffering. So that's kind of the left side of this diagram here. We have a painful feeling, either in the body or the mind. We don't like it. Try to move away from it. One of our strategies, the instant reaction is a feeling of unpleasant. But if that's not noticed and worked with, that will escalate to aversion. And if, in this case, in this formulation, if the aversion isn't dealt with, we tend to want to get out of it by seeking delight and sensual pleasure. And the underlying causes of that are lust for sensual pleasure and ignorance of gratification, danger, and escape, which is suffering. Now let's move over to the trained mind. The trained mind feels that first dart just as fully as the untrained mind. It's unpleasant. But the trained mind feels that painful feeling without aversion. And by feeling it without aversion, by actually being aware, staying aware of that painful feeling, knowing that it's unpleasant, acknowledging that it's unpleasant, fully feeling the unpleasantness of it, the pain of it, there's no need to go seeking delight and sensual pleasure because we understand this is just suffering. This is the first noble truth. The knowledge, the understanding that suffering exists in the world. And we are striving to understand suffering. The first task of the four tasks is to understand suffering. So because we're using our awareness to understand our suffering, we're not afraid of the painful feeling. We're actually interested in it. We're able to investigate it. We're able to stay with it. We're able to let it play out and to find out that that painful feeling is also impermanent. By not seeking delight and sensual pleasure, that underlying tendency of lust for sensual pleasure doesn't play out. And this is a result of the wise knowledge of gratification, danger, and escape. So in this case, gratification is actually understood to be the peace that comes with practicing concentration. I think in his notes, Bhikkhu Bodhi has another factor besides concentration. The escape is concentration, the path, and the fruit. So concentration, and I think by that it means the entire practice of mindfulness. And then the path and the fruit are the stages of awakening that follow when we follow this path for a long time. And are able to actually realize some release. So that's true gratification. Because we understand the danger of holding on when things are impermanent. So that's the trained mind that understands danger as being holding on when things are impermanent. And the trained mind knows that true escape is release. It's not holding on. It's not falling prey to these tendencies to chase after the pleasant and run away from the unpleasant. And as a result, there's no suffering. So there's only one arrow. So even though the story is called The Two Arrows or The Two Darts, I think we know from our own experience that it's way more than two. At every one of these stages, it's an additional arrow. And then, you know, sometimes we use the language in our beginning class. Just last Tuesday, we taught the lesson about the cycle of reactivity. You know, and this goes on and on. An unpleasant feeling in the body leads to aversion. That leads to thoughts in the mind. That leads to unskillful emotions. That causes us to feel more unpleasant. Then we tend to escalate that into unskillful speech and behavior, and the whole cycle begins again, because that unskillful speech and behavior causes more unpleasantness, more aversion, and the cycle goes on. Every stage of that, there's a new arrow.
I'm trying to make sense. The untrained mind, is that inherent in us? I mean, is the various stages, had we not intervened with something, is our behavior then inherent in the human being, that kind of response? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, the something is awareness. That's the something that intervenes, is awareness. I don't know. In this system, I would fall short of saying that the behavior is inherent in the human being. I mean, the model that we try to hold is that the true nature, our true nature, is obscured by these defilements that I was talking about earlier. Greed, anger, jealousy, you know, holding on, tightness, all of that realm. And so the idea is that the true nature is there and we need to purify it. This is the path of purification. We need to purify it by learning to deal with those defilements, if you will. I know that's kind of a loaded word for some, but we need to deal with those, and the way we do that is through awareness. So I don't think it's inherent, but when we are operating on autopilot, then the tendency is to fall into habit patterns that cause ourselves and others suffering. But these are just habit patterns that have developed because of unskillful response to the stresses in our life. They're not, I don't think they're inherent necessarily. And then the training is just to be aware of them. Follow-up question, please.
I'm just thinking of other cultures and how, the differentiation between why certain cultures may not have the same I don't know what I'm saying, but is this whole the steps that follow, if we're not aware, are there cultures where there is less movement I don't know.
Less reactivity?
Less what?
Reactivity?
Yeah. Something like it's that I'm thinking, are we all the same? Are we, where does that come from?
Is that endemic to human nature?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I don't know if that makes
I don't see any of our resident anthropologists, but
Is that even a question?
Well, it's a valid question, but I'm not sure how useful it is in terms of our everyday practice.
Right.
I mean, it would be nice to know that there are human beings out there that are born enlightened, but I haven't met one yet. They may be out there. I just don't know. I think it takes some work. Yeah.
So in the Why Buddhism is True, the author talks about the evolutionary function of some of the, you know, wanting things that are pleasant and pushing away things that are unpleasant.
Uh-huh.
And the evolutionary value originally of a lot of our reactions. And his, he talks about the genius of the Buddha in seeing that many of these responses that, you know, that allowed for the survival of the ones that survived were the ones that, you know, in terms of social relationships and everything. So that the genius of the Buddha was seeing that these were not necessarily, these were what caused suffering after, you know, after we were out of the trees. So I think, you know, it's, when you say inherent, they are long conditioned, they evolve as responses to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, when society became more complicated, they were less functional. They didn't work as well.
Right, right. So she's talking about a book by Robert Wright called Why Buddhism is True. That looks at some of the evolutionary background to some of the Buddhist teachings. And I think probably the answer to your question would be that it would be expressed very differently in different cultures, but that the underlying impulses are similar from one place to another because of what she just explained, that some of these impulses... You know, the Buddha said that this practice was, in a sense... going against the stream. And I think what we would say in modern language about that is that what he meant was that actually in some cases we have to counteract our what we might think of as our evolutionary wiring. That some of these things that we're doing, like not necessarily following our impulse to chase after the pleasant or following some of our impulses to move away from the unpleasant, are necessary to train the mind to be stable enough to actually stay aware from one moment to another and not be running off into these behaviors which tend to move us into ignorance. Which in this context, ignorance does not mean that we don't know a fact that is there to be known. Ignorance means willfully ignoring what's actually happening in the moment. That form of ignorance. So, yeah.
Because the thing that I finally am getting about this is it's a different way to be able to make a choice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not that you don't do something that feels pleasant or don't leave something that is unpleasant or aversive, but
right.
You actually know what you're doing when you're doing
that's
it.
That's right.
And that's really... It's not subverting how our natural attention, what's natural. It gives you more information about what's actually wholesome and skillful.
That's right. Right. So the difference between the second, third, fourth, and fifth arrows and stopping somewhere before that is the ability to stay conscious enough to make a choice and say, I'm not going to go there.
Which is tricky in its own way, because speaking for myself, I was so used to being pulled around by the liking and disliking that I sometimes don't even know how to make a choice.
Yeah.
I mean, it almost feels like I don't know what information, I know I don't have the right information, but I don't know what the right information is sometimes. I mean,
that's
It's very interesting. It's a different way of, it's really a different way of learning about what things are.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and especially when we believe our thoughts.
Yes.
And we, you know, again, I was just talking to the I love teaching this beginning class because you get these little insights, but I was talking to the class last week about the fact that, you know, we tend to think that our thoughts are our own, right? We believe them. But we tend to think that our emotions are somebody else's fault. You know? He made me angry. He, you know, he made my parents, my depression is because of my parents. My, you know, that sort of thinking. And, you know, honestly, when we bring awareness, as you're saying, when we bring awareness to all of this, we realize none of that's true. They're all just happening in response to causes and conditions. Emotions are coming up, thoughts are coming up. You know, there may be some sort of pattern to it. I mean, you know, certain kind of thoughts may be associated with certain sorts of emotions, but it's not someone else's fault, and it's not our fault. You know, the system is this mind-body-heart system is just responding to stimuli. And, you know, if we're lucky, we can hang on a little bit and actually be aware to some extent of what's going on. So yeah, choice is definitely a factor in the ability to limit ourselves to 3 or 4 arrows instead of 19.
And Rich.
Yeah.
And also I would... My experience also is being willing to do the experiment, find out when you do it wrong 30 times and you're paying attention, eventually you'll learn that, oh, I've got to get the sum of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Right. And not judging it as wrong,
yeah,
right?
Oops,
right.
Yeah.
Just understanding this is all an experiment.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Right.
And it cuts down on all the blame and shame.
That's right.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, wrong isn't wrong and right isn't right. Because right is not, you know, morally correct in this system, right? Right means just right.
Right. And successful in terms of suffering.
Right. Yeah. So the other interesting thing about this is that this is really just another model for what we call dependent origination, you know, that cycle of reactivity. So the painful feeling would be vedana, right? The pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, that intuitive, that kind of first conscious link in the chain of dependent origination, that we're something that we can actually notice, and it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and our tendency after that is aversion, desire, or ignorance. You know, aversion growing out of the unpleasant if we don't notice it. Desire growing out of the pleasant if we don't notice it. And ignorance growing out of the neither, out of the neutral if we don't notice it. And then from there, the cycle just goes on with greater and greater degrees of attachment. So at the end of the sutta, the Buddha also points out again that the path of suffering at each stage is carried on by attachment. The path of freedom at each stage is carried on, this translation says detachment, but what it means is non-attachment. And so each of the escalating degrees of suffering in dependent origination are driven by this holding on from, you know, vedana or the feeling tone of experience to the what's sometimes called craving or tanha, and then into upadana, which is really grasping, really holding on. That's when it goes from I want to I need. I need this. Either I need to have this or I need this to go away or I can't be okay. It's kind of the subtext to that. And then that leads to identification, attachment identification, and then the whole cycle starts again. So I thought this was kind of interesting to view as an alternative model to that. In this case, he, even though he discusses the pleasant in seeking delight and sensual pleasure, he doesn't go through it in as much detail in the sutta as he does with the painful feeling. So. Any other questions about or comments about this process? Yeah.
Are you saying that the aversion and greed and delusion only arise if you're unaware of what's happening?
Yes. I believe that eventually we could experience a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling without having it escalate all the way into desire, aversion, and ignorance, and the unskillful speech and action that result from that, because of awareness, because we're actually aware of those when they arise. And with experience, as was set up here, you know, those times when we fail to notice it and it goes plays all the way out, from our experience we know how unpleasant that is. We know how unpleasant it is to go all the way through that process. We might know it from, you know, the look on the face of the person that we've said something to that was really unskillful. So, yeah. The idea is that this can be eventually scaled back in both frequency and intensity because we bring awareness.
I always struggle with this when we get on this topic, but... I'm trying to delineate the concept of it's unskillful to just run after the pleasurable and push away the unpleasurable, to conceptualize that with the concept of, well, we do need to avoid harm and pain. Mm-hmm. And when something in a toxic situation, you need to get out of it, otherwise you're going to cause yourself harm. And that's separate from just pushing aversion away.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to clarify that in my mind with different concepts.
Yeah. So again, in if you want to frame it in terms of awareness, so the noticing the tendency to want to run away from the unpleasant or run toward the pleasant is going to help us stop before we get to the point of using unskillful speech and behavior. The awareness, it's really a different form of awareness. The awareness that putting, because we're recognizing that everything is due to causes and conditions, right? So the awareness that putting ourselves in a certain situation is going to lead to harm, and removing ourselves from that situation is skillful because it's a recognition of the causes and conditions. Based on experience, we know that under certain conditions, you know, if we, for example, you know, we might have a coworker that pushes our buttons, and if we haven't had enough sleep the night before, you know, we may know this day I need to kind of avoid that person because my defenses are down a little bit, or my ability to respond is down a little bit because I'm tired, and or, you know, maybe you have some other thing that you're worrying about, you're not able to fully concentrate on it. So avoiding that person isn't a form of aversion. It's actually a form of what we call guarding the sense doors. You know, it's preventing something that we know is going to set up conditions for unskillful response or an unskillful reactivity, and preventing that from happening. So it's actually self-care. It's a form of kindness. And it's understanding how causes and conditions play out in our particular mind-body system.
But I would have the question, though, that wouldn't that isn't it possible, though, that at the same time that that's true, it's also true that it's just more pleasurable to stay away from the jerk at work?
Nothing wrong with pleasure. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. The Buddha never said don't experience pleasure. It's just this seeking delight in sensual pleasure in response to the underlying tendency to lust for sensual pleasure and thinking that's going to bring us satisfaction. That's the mistake. It's not experiencing pleasant things, you know, whether it's the sunshine or enjoying the rain or smelling a flower. There's nothing wrong with any of that. It's when we indulge in that without awareness of what's actually happening that we're causing harm to ourselves and others.
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Yeah. So rather than thinking of it as moving toward the pleasant, I mean, you can think of it that way. But another way to think of it is that you're moving away from suffering. And Buddha said he only taught one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. That's exactly what this is, suffering and the end of suffering. Exactly what he's teaching in this sutta, suffering and the end of suffering. 1, 2, 3, 7, 8, 15 arrows is suffering. You know, one arrow is, well, it's not great, but it's, if we can be aware of it, it could be the end of suffering. And so if you frame it that way, And this is where the choice comes in. The choice is knowing what conditions lead to suffering and what conditions don't. That's called discernment. So if we can exercise discernment and we know, if I put myself in this situation, I'm going to suffer and maybe the people around me are too. If I remove myself from that situation, all that suffering's not going to happen. There's a choice there, and I think we'd want to choose the second one. Questions, comments, experiences, recognition. Anybody want to talk about the relief at stopping at the first, second, or third arrow?
Well, if you stop at the first, second, or third arrow, you don't have to maintain a certain vigilance of avoiding future dealings with the same issue, mm-hmm. you know. And I'm sure we've all had experience with that, where we think we could hide from something, mm-hmm. and it comes back to bite us again and
right.
again and again.
Right, right.
And just in the last year, I've been trying to practice that. And when something adverse that I consider a negative thing happens, I try to deal with it immediately.
Yeah.
Even though it's more painful.
In the short run.
In the short run.
Yeah.
Say, for example, something's wrong with your car. You know, I had an issue with one of my tires, right? So I could have just kept filling it up with air and eventually, you know, it would have blown out on me. Or I bit the bullet and bought a new tire. It was a little more painful that initial time.
Yeah.
Now I don't have to worry about the tire.
Right, right.
You know, it's also, you don't have to maintain that level of, it's tearing the Band-Aid off
yeah.
slowly.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and so much of this is learning our patterns because they've developed from repetition. And so if we can actually repeatedly exercise the kind of awareness that stops that process from rolling out, we're going to develop a new habit.
Yeah, so. That's a good point.
Short-term, long-term again.
Yeah.
Might be painful, as he pointed out, it's going to be probably a little quite unpleasant in the short term to actually face painful feeling. But once we've done that a few times, you know, we start to establish a new pattern. We start to get that confidence that, hey, I can actually go there without and still survive in terms of what we were talking about earlier.
Today it's a tire, tomorrow it's a water heater.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's always something.
it always
and as long as you realize it's always, as she said, always going
right.
to be something.
Right. Yeah, we were talking earlier in before the break about the about sickness. And Steve Armstrong says when we get sick, instead of saying poor me or why me, we should say it's about time. Right? I mean, it's like the tire. If it's not the tire, it's going to be the refrigerator. If it's not that, it's going to be something else. So when we get sick, it's just, that's the nature of humanity, right? Old age, sickness, and death. There they are.
Right, and by avoiding sickness, I mean, you're not going to totally avoid sickness, but if you practice proper hygiene, you might not get sick as often, if we're talking about flu or colds or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really aversion.
Right.
That's just self-care.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The experience I've had with tracking this is, I'm the Buddhist personality types, I'm definitely an averse type. And so since I was always chased by not wanting to look at something because it was awful, what I've noticed since I don't do it as much is the pleasant times are actually much cleaner because they're not in response to trying to go get away from something, because you can't ever really get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you were saying about blaming other people, it's like that puts it out there and it makes it a force that has nothing to do with you. So you can't actually deal with it in some ways. But once it starts to be here and something you can actually be present with, it's much cleaner too. It's not, somehow it's weirdly not as painful. That extra added mental push is really, at least for me, it was pretty excruciating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably, this has been a huge practice area for me, so like I was really wanting to come and listen to this tonight. Because it's really profound and subtle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding it, I find all those little flicks a lot. The little, I don't like this. And every time I catch it, I notice a relief.
Right.
Right, and it also gets more complicated because not just the tire, it's the refrigerator, the water heater. Suddenly you have all these arrows. You have 10 arrows that maybe you could have reduced over time. But suddenly it's all at the same time. And that's really overwhelming.
That's right.
Well, I've noticed with just letting the first arrow hit and not having the blaming or the blame tendencies, that I don't have to keep apologizing.
Yes.
I had a friend that had, he was an alcoholic, and he would say terrible things and he'd call up and apologize. And it's like, I said, don't you just get tired of having to apologize all the time for saying these things? And so, you know, I have found that it doesn't always work. The other day I needed to apologize to an anonymous person I couldn't find. But with my kids, you know, if they say something, I don't just shoot back at them and then have to backtrack and, you know, try to make things okay and apologize. So much less apologies going on in my life. Much less talking.
Great, thank you. Good point.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tire, refrigerator, water heater, all that, it's because we desire convenience. You can simplify your life. But nobody wants to do that, including myself.
Right, right. Good point. Yeah. The old joke about the Mexican fisherman, right? The guy used to go down on vacation to Mexico all the time and to go fishing, and he'd see the fishermen in the village, and you know, all you've got to do is, you know, go out and catch more fish, and then you could buy a bigger boat, and then you could, you know, build up your business, and then you could save for retirement, and then you could go fishing. I think you got the model wrong. You know, this guy's already living the life. Yeah, all these conveniences that end up being burdens. Yeah.
I was just going to say that I think for me,
something that challenges, it's not so much the refrigerator and the tire, but the part of it's guarding the sense doors, and then part of it is when they're not guarded, to be able to hold things with equanimity.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't turn or isn't the near enemy, which is indifference.
Yes.
And I find that challenging because
right.
I think if there's a mental end, for me at least, there's a tendency to numb out, but just to sort of like, oh, I get it's too much. It's overstimulation. It's like the neurons have stopped responding.
Right.
And I think that's as hard. Even when I can see it.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at the beginning when I was saying, you know, well, in the Buddhist time, sure they had physical pain. I mean, you're out there in the agricultural field and you twist your ankle or whatever, but did they really have as much mental anguish as we do? You know, I mean, I think, you know, with the 24-hour news cycle and things like that, even when the news is not unpleasant, it's wearisome. It is, and so I think you phrased that really well, that just the very act of taking in so much information, I don't think we were built for that. I don't think we were built for taking in that much information, even when it's not unpleasant, even though most of it is, but even when it's not, just taking in that much information, I think, is overwhelming, and it lowers our defenses, and it sort of shuts us off. I agree with you. My default when I'm overwhelmed like that with information is shut down. You know, it's not aversion or desire. It's like, just numbness. Let me out of here. Let me go do something mindless, you know? Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So, I mean, even though the write-up I did for the e-news emphasized the fact that we've had so much bad news, and I think about the fact that just since I wrote that, you know, we've had a few more human tragedies. That's kind of what I was thinking of at the time. But I completely agree with you. I think the very act of taking in so much stimulus is harmful. I think that's why we respond in the way we do to even like the 45 minutes we had here together tonight, or the, you know, going on retreat for a weekend or a day long or a week or 10 days or whatever it might be. I think that's why we respond to that so deeply, is that we don't understand that just the intake of information, even when it's not harmful in itself, inherently harmful, just the intake of information is wearisome. It's you know, kind of
I don't think we know how to shut down or filter that information anymore.
Yeah.
It's so prevalent, you can't seem to shut it off.
Well,
unless you go to a retreat. Unless you
I mean,
turn off the news, unless you turn off the radio.
You can do that, right.
The TV, the radio, the computer,
that's an option.
There are those options.
That is an option.
But I mean, the feel, if you don't do that, if you do that, then there's a tendency to think I'm missing something.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
I'm not saying we can't do it. I'm just saying is we don't.
Right. But, you know, go on a day, go on a week-long retreat and come out of that and see how much you've missed. Right?
Everything's changed.
Yeah, everything's changed.
Everything and nothing.
Everything and nothing. It's absolutely right.
I sometimes think of meditation these days as a vacation. I mean, I'll sometimes say to myself, okay, you right now, you don't have to do anything else or respond to anything else.
Right.
Except what's going on right now in this moment.
Yeah.
For this period of time, you don't have to hear any of that. You don't have to respond
right.
to the other things. You can just go in and and try to stay present. And of course, your mind skitters around all the places, all the other stuff will
jump right.
in. But it's like, but okay, here I can just tell it to jump back out.
Right.
You know, I can just note it and not have to follow it in the way
right.
that you do in working on comprehending whatever's coming at you. In
that's right. Yeah. I had a group of folks over at my house last night that are not meditators, but we do some spiritual stuff together. And we sat at the beginning for 3 minutes, and I rang the bell at the end. And I didn't say anything until the bell stopped ringing. Which, with the bell I have at home, that's over a minute. And one of the people at the end of the night, we always do likes and wishes. One of the people said, "I really like that silence." You know, and I'm thinking, wow. 1 minute of silence, you know? And I totally got it, but I thought, oh, I should convert. I'm not a very good proselytizer, but I thought I should talk to this person about meditation because she liked that 1 minute that much, you know? Think about how much 45 would do for you. So.
I find it interesting, though, that in Thailand, their sanghas there, their temples there, they meditate to the news. They have the news blasting over the speakers, and they just they sit silently with that noise.
Taking it all in.
I found that when I came back, it was much easier to meditate afterward. The noises and sound didn't bother me. It was just felt pretty economist to it.
Right.
I just didn't respond to words or anything. Just
sit. That's right. Thanks for that.
I sort of have a different take on the 24-hour news cycle. My problem is not the amount of information, because in reality, I feel like they're not really giving us much information, repeating the same thing over and over again. That's what gets tiresome. That's what gets frustrating. Case in point, and I hate to bring up human tragedy, but, you know, sort of was your catalyst here. Do we have any resolution in what the heck was going on with that guy in Las Vegas? Suddenly it's not a story anymore. I'd still like to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we moved on to something else. And
right.
we're only going to get so much about those things. We're not getting any really in-depth coverage anymore.
That's right. And it kind of gets back to what was said here, that, you know, everything and nothing changes in a week when you pull out of that cycle.
Yeah.
But there seems to be some kind of, some kind of pleasure getting from having all this at us, yet here it is, we're all saying, we don't like it, you know.
Right.
But there's something about it that is, you know, gives us some kind of gratification on,
yeah.
you know, something, even though it's seemingly painful.
Right.
That we can't seem to turn off.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Is there a response to that?
Well, I was going to say, I guess if you were an evolutionary psychologist, you'd say something like, you know, you get little shots of dopamine when you get that email or when you see the, so there's like this hardwired thing that's giving you pleasurable brain chemicals when certain things happen.
Yeah. The other piece of it, I don't work in an office anymore, but I know when I did, there's something about that social animal part of us that, as someone said, kind of wants to be up on things just so they can relate to other people. So I don't know how much of it is that.
Also, it's a great way to avoid your own issues.
That's right. There's something to that.
Yeah. I remember Donald Rockford was here last year, about a year ago. It was just before the election, and he was talking about really the addictive nature of exactly what you're talking about and how
I mean, he described a behavior which I thought, which was, you know, running to the computer every few minutes to read, to see what was going on, and looking for this hit of input. And I think some of it is avoidance of our own issues, but whatever it is, it has an addictive quality, whether it qualifies truly as an addiction or not.
Yes.
I think that that's what happens with a lot of us, with various forms of stimulation, of input. And
that's right.
Guarding the sense doors means being aware that that's what's happening, and that those sense doors are taken in more than we can deal with.
Right. On that note, just want to let you know, in case you want to send me an email or have some questions, that starting next Wednesday, I'm going to be on a self-retreat for a week, so I'll be out of touch with all electronics and all of that. So I'm just doing it in my house this time, but from the 15th to the 22nd, I'll be out of touch. If you want your email to be responded to, send it toward the end of that week. Otherwise, it's going to be buried.